terms of preparing for the Haggadah, there's a certain type of preparation you should utilize. Because it's really supposed to be a night of exploration. There should be an element of discussion, of spontaneity. And especially with regard to the children. Now, one of the problems I find in most houses where they have the Seder is that everybody knows, you know, the Haggadah, and you read through, and you sing the songs. And aside from the fact that people are tired, because it is late already, and the drinking of the wine, aside from that, is that people don't realize what the nature of the evening is supposed to be about. It's really supposed to be an exploration. It's supposed to be a discussion, a telling of the story, and it should be fresh. There should be insights, and you should ask really legitimate, you know, questions, good questions, to stimulate a conversation. That's why you have the story of the rabbis, the mice of Rabbi Elazar, the story of Rabbi Elazar, and all the other rabbis that got together in B'nai Brak. That's a follow-up. If you follow the Haggadah, for example, on page 26. Also, you have to correct some misunderstandings. The part in which you begin the Sipur, the telling of the story, I'm going to focus tonight on the Halach Ma'anya, but I'll just give a little background before we get to that. Because, of course, it starts off with Kiddush. And the Seder starts off with Kiddush. Okay, a setting of the Seder plate, but that's, you know, that's just preparation. I'm talking about the actual Seder itself. And the Kiddush is unique. You make Kiddush on every Yom Tov, you make Kiddush on every Shabbos. But the Kiddush at the Seder is unique in two ways. What are the two ways in which this Kiddush is unique? Well, first of all, the Kiddush can only be said when it's actually nightfall. In fact, we're going to read about that in the Haggadah itself. Because on page 30, the paragraph called Yochol Me'Rosh Chodesh, I would have thought that it's from Rosh Chodesh. In Hebrew, it's very cryptic. It needs a lot of explanation. Well, I would have thought it's from Rosh Chodesh. What are we talking about? All right, so really it's talking about the mitzvah to tell the story of the Exodus, which is called Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the Haggadah here is discussing how do I know the time, when the time of this mitzvah is. And it brings verses from the Torah to back it up. Then it says, Yochol Mebo'od Yom. Once it fixes on the day, by Yom Ahu, on that day meaning the 15th. So then it says, I would have thought, Mebo'od Yom, that perhaps while it's still day, thus it says, Bavur Zeh, because of this. Bavur Zeh Lo Amarti, the words because of this do not apply, except at the time when the matzah and the moror is placed before you. It's trying to establish the time of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So it's already pointed out which day. Which day? The day of the 15th. Then it says something funny. I would think, Mibaod Yom, while it's still daytime. What does that mean? Because we know that the night comes before the day on the Jewish calendar. So when it says, so now we know that it has to be on the 15th, that would mean the night. What do you mean when it's still, while it's still day? Now while it's still day would mean before nightfall of the 15th. But the problem is, before nightfall of the 15th, it's the 14th, so how can he even have a thought that he would be able to do it? So really it's a reference to something that is called Tosfos Yom Tov, or Tosfos Shabbos, which means that you can begin the Shabbos, you can begin the holiday earlier, at a certain point in the day. The halfway point between the afternoon mincha, the late mincha, and sunset. The halfway point is called plag ha-mincha, the splitting of the mincha, which in halachic time would be about an hour and a quarter before sunset. That's in the summertime, for example. A lot of people start Shabbos earlier, but it's not Shabbos yet. It's not the seventh day, it's still Friday. The answer is you have the right to accept it upon yourself, the sanctity of the day. When it's that close, about an hour and a quarter. It's not 60 minute hours, they have to be calculated, but I'm just in rough terms. Now, when you do that, for you it's completely Shabbos. The sanctity of the Shabbos, because you can add from the from the holy to the profane, so to speak. You can extend the Shabbos. You can extend it at both ends. When that happens, it's officially Shabbos. You can't do any work. And you can make Kiddush. So that's why people that go to the early minyan on Shabbos, they come home and they make Kiddush. The same is true on a Yom Tov, on a holiday. It's thought earlier. What about on Pesach? On Pesach, can you do the same thing? So that's what he's saying. I would have thought that you can make Kiddush while it's still day, meaning at that point in time, if you decide to start Pesach early, so now it has the sanctity of the Pesach and I can still make Kiddush. That's what he's saying. But the answer is that you can't. Which means that Pesach too can be started earlier. But if you start Pesach earlier while it's still day, before it's nightfall, you can't make Kiddush. For Kiddush, you have to wait until it's actually nightfall. How do I know? Because it says, Bavurzeh, it says concerning the mitzvah of Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim, that because of this did God take me out of Egypt. Because of this. Because of this is a reference to the mitzvahs. That is to say that God took us out of Egypt, not just to be removed from slavery and to do whatever we please, but for a purpose, to designate us to be the nation that would keep the Torah. So therefore, the story of the Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim has to be said in conjunction with the mitzvos of the night. That's what it means, matzah and morah, at the time when the matzah and morah is placed before you. So when is the matzah and morah placed before you? At night. Because that's the time of the mitzvah. The time of the mitzvah of matzah is that night. The time of the mitzvah of morah is that night. And since the telling of the story is connected to those mitzvos, has to be said when they're placed in front of you. Therefore, I know that the mitzvah of Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim has to be at night and cannot be while it's still day. Meaning, even if you do accept the holiday earlier, so it's true, the holiday begins, you can't do work, but you can't say Kiddush because the mitzvah starts when it's actually night, which is the time of Matzah Morah. But let me ask you this question. So someone says, okay, fine, that I have to tell the story in the presence of the Matzah Morah. So why can't I start while it's still day and put matzah in front of me for morah for me? It means that it's not the physical object of the matzah that it has to be stated. It has to be stated in front of the objects of mitzvah that are being utilized for the mitzvah. So it doesn't obtain the status of an object of mitzvah until the time of the mitzvah. The rest of the year, it's just unleavened bread. It's just romaine lettuce. It does not have the status of being morah. Morah is the term for the object of the mitzvah. Same is true, for example, lulav. Now, a lulav on the holiday has a status of being a lulav. You can't use it to sweep up some things off the floor because it's not. But after the holiday, you can. Before the holiday, you can. Why? It's not a lulav. It's just a palm branch. The second way in which the Kiddush at the Seder differs from Kiddush all year. Question. On Friday night, regular Friday night, Kiddush. Do you have to drink from the wine? Does each person that's present, one person, I assume, whoever, whether it's the man or woman can make Kiddush too, makes the Kiddush and everybody has in mind that that person is saying it for them, and you just say, amen, and that fulfills, you don't recite. Not everybody every person recites the Kiddush. Does everybody drink from the wine? Must you drink from the wine on Friday night or on Yom Tov night to fulfill your mitzvah of Kiddush? Friday night, it's a mitzvah, so to speak, to drink, but if you didn't drink, let's say for whatever reason, you're allergic, you didn't feel like it, whatever the case is, you fulfilled the mitzvah, as long as one person drinks. Because the recitation has to be said over wine, like a toast, it has to be said over wine. So one person, preferably the one who makes the Kiddush, has to drink, because he's connecting the Kiddush to the wine. What about, but the rest of the people, if they didn't drink, they fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush. But what about the Kiddush at the night of the Seder?
Of course, it's the first course.
You have to drink. So there, it's the first course, exactly. Because aside from the idea that Kiddush has to be said over wine, that wouldn't obligate each person to drink. But since it's the mitzvah, it's the first of the four cups, that's a mitzvah on everybody. So therefore, you have to drink the cup. Let's say you didn't drink by Kiddush. Did you fulfill your obligation of Kiddush?
Yes.
It's so far as Kiddush is concerned.
Oh, it's Kiddush, not right.
You did. Kosh you did. Kosh you did. There's a mitzvah to drink four cups as an expression of freedom. But each cup is connected to some aspect of the night. It's not just a matter of drinking a cup of wine.
Right.
But that cup of wine has a significance because it's associated with a certain aspect. The first is the cup of Kiddush. What's the second cup? The second cup is set over the Haggadah. Then you recite the whole Haggadah. And if you, then you say the first two paragraphs of the Hallel, then the blessing, Asher Golanu, that God redeemed us. And then you drink the second cup. And what is the third cup connected to? The third cup is over Birkat HaMazon. Now, Birkat HaMazon also partakes of... See, all the cups have to have something to do with the mitzvah of Sipri, Yetzias Mitzrayim, some aspect of the Exodus. So, Kiddush, of course, has an aspect of the Exodus because it expresses the sanctity of the day, that the day is sanctified because on this day God took us out of Egypt. The second one, of course, is over the Haggadah, which tells the story of the Exodus. The third one is over the Birkat HaMazon. What does the Birkat HaMazon have to do with the Exodus? In the Bracha of Nodlucha, we mentioned the Al Shehot, the Son of Meir, the Shrine. One of the things we're giving thanks for is that God took us out from Egypt. Also in the Al Viavo, Chag HaMatzah says that. It's another reference. So that's the third cup. And then, of course, the fourth cup. What's the fourth cup set over? Famous story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who said, I am as one who was 70 years old. And I never understood why we mention the Exodus at night, until Ben Zoma expounded it, and then he quotes the verse, in order that you shall remember the day you left Egypt all the days of your life. So then he brings out a halachic argument. So one side says that the days of your life is a reference to the daytime, all the days is the evening. The other one says no, the days of your life is a reference to the present era, all the days is a reference to the Messianic era. So it's a beautiful halachic argument. We took it up this past Shabbos. Like, what does it have to do with the story of the Exodus? We're talking about a mitzvah in Kriyat Shema to mention the Exodus, which is not the same thing as the mitzvah of Sipur. But apart from all of that, so my question was, all right, so let's say it is important, but why do we, it's brought down as an anecdote in the life of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Why do we have to know that he was 70 and then he didn't understand and so on and so forth? So the point is that it's trying to communicate something to you, that Judaism is a body of infinite knowledge, and that the true scholar is one who's never too, always has that youthful enthusiasm for learning something new. So it's communicating that even someone like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who was one of the greatest sages, in a sense you could say he was stumped on a rather elementary point. He didn't know why you said Yetzias Mitzrayim at night. And until he learned something from Ben Zoma, Ben Zoma came along, and he was thrilled to learn something from Ben Zoma. So I was mentioning today how different the attitude of the Torah is towards knowledge. Because in any other field of knowledge, basically, you know, when they're young, scientists are always trying to break down the establishment and question. Then they're very open, looking for new ways. But then they become the establishment, and so the mind becomes closed. And the idea that I could learn from somebody else or someone who's not as great as me, that's because it's an egocentric kind of a striving. But it's trying to tell you that the great scholars didn't approach learning from any egocentric approach.
It's still just an interpretation. I mean, Ben Zoma thinks that it's...
The answer is that after the meal, the last part of the Haggadah is the Hallel, the recitation of Hallel, praise, giving praise to God. And the fourth cup then is at the end of Hallel. The Hallel is ended with Yishtabach, the blessing. That's the blessing after Hallel. Mm-hmm. And then you drink the fourth cup. So the fourth cup is part of the Hallel. Because, of course, the story is not complete without the giving of praise, the recognition of the significance. Now, we understand what each of the four cups relate to. However, I'm going to raise another page 44. Actually, we'll go back even more. Because the recitation of the story takes place in different forms in the Haggadah. Different forms of reciting the story. One way is simply reciting the story in your own words. There should be a subjective where people stop and just tell over the story in your own words. The Haggadah incorporates another way. And that is the part which begins by Atzei Ulamad, go and learn. On page 32, we have Atzei Ulamad, go and learn. And what it does is to retell the story, but what form is being used to tell the story from that point, part which begins with Atzei Ulamad, go and learn? Through the vehicle of the Torah. So it's one thing to tell a narrative on the basis of the history and what you know about it and what you understand. But the Haggadah demands that you study the story as it has been recorded in the Torah in conjunction with the exegesis of the rabbis. So it goes through the same terrain. That begins with Atzei Ulamad, go and learn. Now learn Torah. Because the only way to get to the full depth of the story is by studying it through the Torah. And that brings down all the psukim. The Egyptians, it tells us the story about how the Jews became successful in Egypt. They went down Nimsei Ma'at with very few people. And then it brings down the exegesis. And there we became a nation, mighty and powerful. Then by a ray of Osanu, that the Egyptians were evil to us, and they afflicted us. So it's going through the terrain of the story with, as I said, through that particular vehicle, the Torah, with the attendant drush, with the attendant exegesis. Which means to say that in order to get the full understanding, it's got to be through the Torah, in terms of the written Torah and the oral Torah. That's part of the mitzvah of the night, to study it in that way. That is basically the second way of Haggadah, of telling the story. On page 42, Rabbi Gamliel introduces something else. Oh, let's read it, and then you'll tell me what he's really doing. Rabbi Gamliel Hayomer, Rabbi Gamliel said, whoever did not say these three things on Pesach did not fulfill his obligation. And they are Pesach, Matzah, Umar. Whoever didn't say these three things. Well, what do you mean? He didn't say the three words? Then he proceeds to explain. Pesach. The Pesach that our forefathers ate in Egypt at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. For what? What was the purpose? And then he gives the explanation. What the purpose? God skipped over the houses, etc. Then he goes to the matzah. Same thing with the matzah. The matzah that we ate, what is the purpose? And he says because the redemption came upon them very quickly. They didn't even have enough time to wait to allow the bread, to allow the dough to rise and leaven. And he quotes the verse which says that. Then he goes on to the Torah. Okay, let's define the nature of this segment. What's the idea? What's his point? Whoever didn't say these three things didn't fulfill his obligation. Obligation of what? What obligation is he talking about? Well, he didn't fulfill his obligation of telling the story. So now this is the third method that has to be employed. One is just telling over what happened. It's best of your ability, as you understand it. The second one is by studying the way the Torah portrayed the story with the proper interpretation. Yet a third way is to tell the story by virtue of explaining the reasons of the mitzvos that story gave rise to. So as he's saying, if you did not study the mitzvah at the time of the Matan Mara, if you didn't study the nature of the mitzvah and learn from the object of the mitzvah what the purpose was, you didn't fulfill your obligation. That's an extremely important point. This part of Rebbe that is that certain parts of the Haggadah, you may have to go inside and take care of yourself, but everybody should make a point to partake, to listen, to recite this part, because this is a vital component. That's the third element of Sefer, telling the story by way of explaining the purpose of the object of the mitzvah. Now let's look at the transition. From there you go, you're going to make your transition into Hallel now, because you finished your primary obligation of retelling the story in every which way. Then, lefichach, because of this, we are obligated to give thanks, to give praise, all these different expressions of praise. Now, Hallel, of course, is praise. So it's really segueing into the Hallel. To bless and to extol all different expressions of praising and extolling for the one who did this for our fathers and for us. Now bear in mind that that's a crucial point, that the Exodus is not something that was done only for our forefathers, but for us as well. We already said it at the beginning, that in Avadim Hayinu, that had God not taken our forefathers out of Egypt, then we and our children and children's children will still have been enslaved. So that's the primary point of the evening. Primary point of the evening is that what took place in history was not just the past, but has a profound impact upon us. It affects us. Otherwise, what's our obligation? What are we getting together and making the whole thing of a historical event, unless it's the foundational event which relates to us as well? Had that not taken place, then we would still be an enslaved people. We would not be a free people.
Yeah, we just got finished reiterating.
We then recite all the things that God did, lavoseinu, for our fathers, velonu, and all them, and for us. So we recite the miracles. He took us out of slavery to freedom, from mourning to joy. Actually, from grief to a holiday, from darkness to light, to a great light, from subjugation to redemption. And let us sing before him a new song. Okay? Then you go into Halleluko. These next two paragraphs are from Hallel. As you know, the first two paragraphs of Hallel. And then the Tzeis Yisrael. See, you can't just recite the Haggadah in a vacuum. It has to be recited from the standpoint of praise. Because as a result of this, we gain a new recognition and appreciation of the Creator. So then you finish Hallel. Then the blessing of Geula. The blessing for the redemption. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam. Asher Ge'alanu, who redeemed us and redeemed our forefathers from Egypt. And brought us to this night, in which to eat matzah and maror. Then we pray that's a prayer that God should bring us to other festivals. We're praying that God will keep us alive and enable us to enjoy other festivals. Rejoicing, this is a key phrase, rejoicing in the building of your city. Now, rejoicing in the building of your city is a reference to the fact that we're lacking something at this point in time. Because we're saying it from the standpoint that people are still in exile, as we see in Halach Ma'anya. Now we are here, next year in Jerusalem. So the prayer over here is that we should merit to sing the redemption and to rejoice in the rebuilding of the city, v'nochal sham, and we will eat there from the sacrifices, the Pesach and so forth. And we will acknowledge you with a new song for our redemption and the redemption of our soul, blessed are you, O God, Gal Yisrael, the Redeemer of Israel. So we finished our obligation to recite the story in those three ways, to segue into praise and Hallel, then the blessing, then the Baruch Ragafe. So, my question is, we've already fulfilled the obligation of Hallel, because that has been incorporated as part of the Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then you go into the eating of the food, the meal, the Birkat HaMazon, which that's the basis of the third cup, and now the fourth cup is Hallel again. So what is the idea? I thought we said Hallel. Why are we saying two Hallels? What's the sense of the Hallel that we say after the meal? Because basically after the meal,
we must be praising somehow for the future.
That's going to be the Hallel. You say the Hallel, and then you finish it up with the blessing of some of the Hallelujah and so forth, or Yishtabach, whatever the case may be. There's different versions of what blessing. And then the Berakah Ragachai. The Hallel that's said after the Berakah HaMazon is really for the future Geula, for the future redemption. Because basically we're living with two redemptions. That's the idea, that there are two Hallels. The first one is for the first redemption. Because we're saying, in a sense, that God redeemed us. And had God not redeemed us, we would have been slaves. So we have achieved a freedom. But the freedom we've achieved means that God has separated us and God has given us the opportunity for freedom through the Torah. So at any time a Jew accesses the Torah, so he can obtain the state of freedom. But the Jewish people as a whole is not in the state of freedom because we're still in foreign lands and because we don't keep the Torah. So that is something which will come to an end when Mashiach comes. There'll be a time when the Jewish people in the entire world will recognize what the truth is and we'll live a completely different kind of life. So that is a fundamental that a Jew is obligated to believe in the Messianic era, that the world the way it is will not remain indefinitely that way, and that the world will be perfected. Tikkun Olam, the world will be perfected. So on this night, we express our gratitude for the future Geula. Now, that is the reason for the cup of Eliyahu. Because, now this is not something which is something we know for sure. But there's a lot of indication, the Rambam brings it down, that before the redemption, before the Mashiach, Eliyahu HaNavi, the prophet Eliyahu, who was the greatest of the prophets after Moshe, will return and will herald, so to speak, will inform us with certain prophecies, preparing us for the advent of Mashiach. That's the idea of the Kos of Eliyahu, because it's reflective of the idea of Mashiach. So, all you do is pour the cup, but it's not the cup that you drink, and you don't, you shouldn't convey the idea to the child that there's some magical thing going on, that Eliyahu is coming around and drinking from everybody's coast. That's not the case. And now I'm just going to take up one paragraph called Holach Ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. Now this is really the beginning of what's called Magid. Magid is the recitation of the story. Now this comes after the Karpas. So first you have the Kiddush, as we said. Everything starts with Kiddush. Then you have the Karpas, which is the dipping of the vegetable. What's the reason for that? It's to attract the curiosity of the child. So to do something which you normally wouldn't do. Now bear in mind that it's not just the dipping of the vegetable, because you don't normally eat the vegetable before the meal. But then you're supposed to remove the plate from the table. And the child was going to ask, why are you taking, we haven't eaten yet, why are you removing the plate from the table? Those two things are formal changes. However, each person in his own right is supposed to do something to attract, because the point was to remind the parent to do something to attract the curiosity, arouse the curiosity of the child. This, of course, expresses the whole philosophy of education, that the best education is one which starts from the question, because if the child is not interested, you're just going to be forcing it.
I heard once.
After that, you do yachatz. Yachatz is the breaking of the matzah. Now, what is the purpose of breaking the matzah? That's because it's reminiscent of the poor man's bread, that poor people, you know, they have broken pieces. They, you know, they can't have a whole piece and so on. They eat in a hurry, they just grab a piece. That's the idea of the prusa. Before we get into the actual maggid, we have this holach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever has a need, let him come and join us for the Passover sacrifice. We don't have it today, but apparently this is said in conjunction with all the, you know, we have all the mitzvahs. Now we are here, and next year may we be in the land of Israel. Now we are slaves, or now we are servants. Slaves is a better word. Next year let us be free. However, we read before about the purpose of the matzah. That is to say that the matzah is really a symbol of redemption. Because we didn't have time.
Yeah, but it's also lechem oni.
Ah, so what is it? Here it's the opposite. Here it's the exact opposite. Lechem oni, the bread of affliction. Which is the exact opposite of what we see. So if somebody asks you, why do we eat matzah? Do we eat matzah because it's a reflection of the slavery, the state of slavery, or do we eat matzah because it's a reflection of the redemption? Actually, that's the truth. It has both designations. Because it is referred to as lechem oni in the Torah, and Rashi explains that it's the bread which reminds us of our oppression, our degradation, our affliction. On the other hand, as we read, it also says that the reason is that the gods came in such a hurry that they didn't have a time to wait for it to rise, so it's really redemption, so it's both. Now, it seems over here that at this point in time, the telling of the story must be over matzah, in conjunction with matzah. So the matzah, in telling of the story at this point, is the matzah of affliction. Because we're going back into the enslavement, that we were slaves. But I'd like to explain a little bit more how it is that one object can signify both what seems to be two opposites. And maybe this will cast some light on the whole idea of Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. And that is that the question arises, what was the reason for the whole enslavement? We read in Nagar that God calculated the end. And God told us to Avraham that you should know that your children will be slaves in a land that is not theirs. And they'll afflict them. And afterwards I will take them in with great wealth. And then I'll judge the nation. I'll judge the nation that afflicted them. So this is something that seems on the surface to be something which is preordained by God. It seems, it doesn't have to be that way, but there's other interpretations. But, you know, one legitimate interpretation is that God is telling Avraham what his plan is for the future. Now, it's interesting that somebody told me, I hadn't seen this myself, he told me about some rabbi in Israel raised a question, which is a good question. And it's the kind of question that might get people's interest. The question he asked was that one of the main ideas is that we have to praise God for everything God did for us, that God, we were enslaved and oppressed, and God took us out, so we have to give great praise to God. He says, yeah, but why do we have to thank God? God put us in that situation in the first place. So if somebody puts you in a situation, for example, I was using the, when I heard the...
Like, thank you for stopping beating me.
Yeah, it's like, let's say somebody was to take you out in the middle of the woods or the jungle and abandon you. And now you're in dire straits. And,
get you.
But obviously God,
and then suddenly comes back and he saves you. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you have to thank me. Thank you,
God.
Another kind of question, which I think can hit people on a general level, universal kind of level, is that whole issue that when God tells Moshe about the Passover sacrifice to bring it, at that point he slips in that please speak to the people that they should ask the Egyptians for gifts. Gifts of gold, jewelry, clothing, and so on and so forth. And the question arises, why? What was the point of having the Jews themselves? That seems to be a major theme, though. Now, of course, it's fulfillment of the promise that God said that when they leave, they won't leave empty-handed. They'll leave with substance. Well, why is that so important? Why is the wealth, the material, so important? But also, if that was the will of God that they should have it, so well, why did it have to come about through this way, that the people, each Jew has to ask his Egyptian friend to give it to them? Why did Moshe demand it as the negotiator, demand it from Paro, make it part of the negotiations? Why each Jew had to go? All those things. But then there's another question, because it seems that they borrowed it. The term by Yashimim, they loaned it to them. Well, that's, what does that mean? If you say that they were asking for a loan, that they should lend them these things, because they're going out in the wilderness, and to serve God, and they wanted these things, if that's the case, was it a loan? And if it's a loan, did they ever return it? No, they never returned it. So were they using deceit? Were they deceiving the Egyptians then by having them lend them their jewelry and with the intention of never giving it back? Is that permitted? And if you say, well, perhaps you'll say that since they had stolen, was that because they had stolen their labor and they hadn't compensated them, so you have a right to do that in that situation? These are some of the questions. Is it comparable to the Germans and the Jews after the Holocaust? Is that the same? For example, see, in that situation now, with the Jews, because they destroyed the Jews, but they also took all their, you know, wealth, they stole their wealth, their property, and so on and so forth. See, in a situation like that, let's say that they refused to give back anything, and the Jews have to resort to deception in order to get it back. Then I would say it's perfectly justified, because that's my money, you know. So I'm not deceiving in a sense. If you have an obligation to give it to him. Is that the same thing over here? There are commentators that maintain that it wasn't a loan. They gave it as a gift. See, Vayash Ilum, they gave it to, that term in Hebrew can denote a gift or can denote a present. So there are different interpretations. Those who maintain that it's really a gift, so it's not a problem. But those who maintain that it was a loan, that they really, the Egyptians didn't give them as a gift, but as a loan, then you do have to face this issue. Were they morally obligated to return it? Was that permitted? And if so, why? Another question that comes up, again, one of these general kinds of questions, is, was there another element of deception? In that, it seems that throughout the negotiations, Moshe never requested the freedom for the Jews. Never requested freedom. And let my people go is not that let us out of here, it was just for a distance of 3 days' journey to worship God, with the implication that they'll come back. Now, if that is the case, that all along that was the idea, and Paro was resisting, and so on and so forth, then he finally gives in, was it then deception that the Jews didn't come back? Was the understanding that the Jews were going to go for the and then come back? Was that deception? And, well, you may say yes, but they had again, you could raise the question, they had a moral right to do so because they had no right to enslave them. What was the fact, though? Were the Jews engaging in deception for a moral purpose, or was it not deception? What really happened over there? In terms of the getting back to the matzah, it's not by accident that the very same object is a symbol of the enslavement and the redemption, because it's integrally related. The Gemara talks about the fact that God, before he gave the Jews the Torah, offered the Torah to the other nations, and each one turned it down. Because basically it meant restriction of the instinctual life. Which means to say, so why were the Jews different? Why were the Jews so willing to put restraint on every area of life and to redirect themselves to the whole different way of thinking and living, the pursuit of the spiritual value, the pursuit of truth? The Jews apparently were not, but the Jews were slaves. The enslavement forced, when a person is successful in pursuing all the fantasies and the material, you can't talk reason to him because he's on top of the world. Very often when people experience a downfall, and they're in a situation where they don't have access anymore, they're in jail or they're sick, whatever it is, then they begin to ponder there must be some meaning in life. And then they discover that there is. And very often you read about that. People in jail undergo a complete transformation and they get completely involved in the world of thought, of learning, of ideas. They discover a whole new world. So therefore the very same phenomenon, when God placed us into the situation of slavery, it was for our benefit. So the analogy we gave before of somebody putting you into the wilderness, just abandoning you for no reason, and then saving you, that's not saving. You don't know how many gratitude. But to the contrary, this was the beginning of the redemption. That the true redemption came about as a result of the fact that we were forced into the most degrading physical situation. So every area of life was cut off, except the soul, that they couldn't steal from us. And when Moshe came to them and proposed to them a completely different way of life, the Jews were mentally prepared to latch onto it. And God calculated the end, the exact moment at which, had he waited any longer, it would have been too late. And then that's why the matzah, the very same matzah, which was the bread of affliction, became the symbol of the redemption. So that's the basic idea. And if we just briefly, I think the whole Achma Anya is expressing the idea of redemption. That the essence of this night, before we get into tell the story, the essence of this night is the story of redemption. For who? For a people. It's a new nation. It's a redeemed people. And that's why the matzah is the symbol, because it was through the experience of the enslavement that there was a transformation. But then, so we emerged. What was the geula? Kolduk fin yesei v'yekol. We're a different kind of people. And our whole experience, the whole idea of getting together to eat a meal is a different kind of phenomenon. Like the Rambam says, for example, on Yom Tov, when you rejoice, you can't just limit it to your friends, to your family, but you have to invite the stranger, the needy. And he says if a person closes his gates towards the needy, so then that's not a rejoicing of mitzvah. He calls that a simchas kreisa, that's rejoicing of the belly, that's just instinctual. So here too, what unites us as a people is the fact that we have a certain concern for every Jew. Kol d'chvin yesei v'yechol is expressing the idea that there's a new entity that's come into existence called Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. And each Jew is concerned for every other Jew. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever is in need, let him come and join us in the Pesach. Pesach is a very interesting mitzvah. That Pesach could only be eaten in groups. And you had to join the group, so to speak. Well, when the Pesach, when it was, people would get together and assign certain, you know, whoever was going to be together on one Pesach. Which means, the other thing that unites us as a people is the fact that we perform mitzvahs together. The community performing mitzvahs. And then, of course, when you reflect upon the state of the Jewish people, Hashat Ha'afa, that this is not the destiny. Our destiny is not to be here. But we never forget that this is a temporary phenomenon. Next year in the land of Israel. Now, of course, this particular phrase, again, perfect question. Why are we saying next year? Now, this made sense for hundreds of years in the exile, but now we have Israel. So why are we saying next year in Israel when we have Israel right now? We can go to Israel right now. And Hashata Avde, now we are slaves. Next year, may we be free. So these last two phrases, when it says over here in Israel, let's say we were having a Seder in Israel. What would you say? Now we are here. Next year, let us be in the land of Israel. But you're in the land of Israel. So would you leave that this phrase? The idea is not referring to Israel geographically. But it's referring to this idea of a redeemed people. And it's recognizing that we're not in the appropriate state. That we're in a state of exile. And even though we have Israel from a physical point of view, it's not the land of Israel. Meaning the land that God designated to set up a society that's functioning according to the system of mitzvahs. And since that's the case, Hashata Avdei, now we are slaves. Well, we're not really slaves. We're not slaves in a physical sense, but to the extent that we're part of an alien culture, which America is an alien culture, that affects us. So that even people that study Torah, even people that study, it's against the tide. You got to fight it. Anyone who has kids, it's not just kids, it's ourselves. You're fighting against the culture. You're fighting against the prevalent philosophy. And even religious people are submerged in the American culture of materialism and success and getting more. And you could be religious, but that doesn't mean you're the enslavement to the in the cultural sense. So that's the Hashanah Ba B'nei Choron. That is the basic introduction to the basic theme, the major theme of what the evening is about. That in the past God intervened and God afflicted us for the sake of redeeming us. We are a redeemed people, and now we look towards the future to actually access the true freedom and the true redemption.